Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and today my guest is Mark Kershaw. He's a passionate advocate for veterans' mental health and the creator of the powerful documentary, Tribal. Mark's journey as an Afghanistan veteran and Army infantryman has led him to a mission-driven endeavor aimed at destigmatizing mental health struggles and addressing the alarming rise in suicide rates among service members. Through his documentary, Mark seeks to spark meaningful conversations and foster a sense of community and understanding among veterans and their loved ones. And with that, I want to welcome you to the show, Mark. I'm really glad to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott. Glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So talked about the documentary, Tribal. I had an opportunity to watch that a few days ago. Really great documentary, really well done. Definitely, I want to encourage people to go out and take that in and watch the documentary. Before we get into the documentary and what it's all about and everything, I want to kind of talk about you and your personal experiences. Can you share your experiences as a soldier who fought in Afghanistan? What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I joined in 2006. So I joined right as the Iraq surge was happening. I was a surge baby. Took me 5 years to get out of high school. So they liked me so much, they invited me back for another year. Wasn't a great student. So I needed something. I think I was failing every single class, like up to December, and we were supposed to graduate in June. Now I was like, oh man, I'm gonna be a loser. Right. So then I got on my high horse. I talked to a recruiter and then I found kind of like a purpose in that moment of like, yeah, I want to be airborne. I want to be Ranger. I want to be air, all this stuff. Right. So they said, hey, you can go in and join on this DEP program. At the time of the DEP program, you can join and, with a promissory of like, hey, you're going to swear in now, but you have to graduate and you swear in again, right? So if you don't graduate, it like breaks the contract. So that was like kind of my North Star. I had like a purpose. And then from that point on, I got on my high horse and just aced everything and graduated like the skin of my teeth. I think like a 2.05 or something like that. I was pretty happy. So went off there, graduated in June, shipped off the basic in August and went through basic infantry and airborne training. Didn't get a Ranger contract. They didn't give that to me, but I got airborne. So went through the basic training, went through airborne. And then funny enough, I got a mechanized contract, which was because I went needs of the Army. So everyone that was kind of shipping off to Iraq at that time, you were just kind of in 2006, you were going to everything the first thing smoking. So I did my tour in Iraq first in 2008 to 2009. It was supposed to be 15 months, but it ended up being 12 months. And I reenlisted there, got my stripes over there as a sergeant, reenlisted for the 82nd Airborne. That's where I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So I was like, this is the only way I'm going to get to go there. Iraq's kind of dying down at the time. I want to go to Afghanistan. I want to be back in the fight, right? So went there, went to the 82nd Airborne. As soon as we get there, we get put on something called the GRF. So if you don't know what the GRF is, it's called the Global Response Force. So it's basically like in case stuff happens, where the in case stuff happens, right?
It's like the QRF, but like for the world.
Yeah, the QRF for the world. That's the 82nd like real mission, not the deployed Iraq and Afghanistan all these times that everyone else on a regular pack start. It's in case something happens, like Libya or something like that. In case something happens, we're supposed to, you know, put a brigade of paratroopers out there. So as soon as I got there, I'm like, yeah, we're gonna go to Afghanistan. I can't wait, man. I'm gonna get back in this fight, you know. Saw all these documentaries, and since I get there, they're like, you're going 3rd Brigade, GRF. And I was like, what's that? They're like, good luck. I'm like, what's that? No, seriously, why is everybody like laughing at me? So I get there and they're like, yeah, we're not deploying for like a year and a half. I'm like, oh my God. So it's just like nothing but training. The former JSOC commander, Ranger Regiment, was our battalion commander, Major General Evans, or he might have gotten promoted even more now, but he took over Ranger Regiment. He was our battalion commander, and we were just in the field. Nonstop, just like in the field every week, just training, rocking. I didn't even know what trans was. We didn't drive anywhere. So did that for about a year and a half. Everyone's like, we're never deploying. Then we got the call. We were out the door in like 3 weeks. So we did something called, it was like the operational ready force or something like that, where they put us in a really bad area, which was the Ghazni province, to support one of our sister brigades, the 1st Brigade. They had already taken like 100 casualties within like 7 months or something like that. And what they wanted us to do was deploy with one of the OD groups, right? ODA 11, it was out of Okinawa, and basically occupy the enemy's movement in like little Taliban hotbeds, right? So it was a direct action mission. So we would deploy to them, just a battalion size element, 3 infantry companies and some support companies, and then basically go to areas where they saw were Taliban hotbed in that AO, and then just start trouble basically, right? So we did that. As soon as we got there, you know, my platoon took casualties the first 7 days. It's in the documentary. Omar and Burchard, we didn't even get to the actual mission. It was a left seat, right seat ride with 1st Brigade, one of the guys, Sergeant Marlowe, still love that guy to this day from 1st Brigade. And I remember we were doing like this first mission, and he was like, hey, we're going to go down this road because our mission is moving to contact. He was like, the last 3 out of 5 times we've done this road, we've taken contact. And most of my platoon had never saw combat before because they were, you know, specialists and below that have been in the army for 2.5 years, and they've been on GRF this whole damn time. So we go down there, we do, you know, bounding overwatch. The weapon squad goes up, and then my squad is starting to move out with the element, and the weapon starts getting pelted and whatnot. And then that whole engagement, I'm not going to spoil it for everyone, but whole engagement goes off, and that's where we took our first couple casualties. And then we spent about 100 days. It was a 100-day deployment in Afghanistan. It was a pretty decent deployment. It was pretty cool to not just like drive around an AO and do things like, you know, it wasn't Iraq at the time, but it was like direct action, you know, going over to Paktika province, Logar. I mean, we were all over RCE. So that was my last deployment before I got out, but it was a pretty kinetic one.
And what year was that again?
That was 2011, 2012.
Okay.
Yeah. Ghazni province. Yeah. So that was kind of like this. I hit both surges. You can say I hit the surge of Iraq and I hit the surge of Afghanistan. So that was like my 2 deployments.
Yeah. So yeah. Timeline wise, I'm just trying to like piece things together and everything. So like when you got in, it was like maybe like a month or two after I finished basic training. That's when you started.
You know, so exactly.
I'm piecing all this stuff together. And when you were just talking, what you were just talking about, 2011 timeframe, that was right after I got out of Afghanistan.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was in.
Oh, 20, wow.
And so we're like almost like at the same, like we just miss each other probably by just a little bit, like on all of these things.
That's pretty funny. That's funny.
So let's talk about the documentary. So for the folks who haven't seen it, aren't familiar with the documentary Tribal. So it talks about some pretty heavy topics, some pretty serious topics. Sometimes the taboo topics, right? Suicide and PTSD and other things like that, challenge the reintegration, right? That's the kind of stuff that we talk about on the show too, because we got to start talking about these things and having conversations about it, because we're losing people. People are thinking to themselves that they're all alone in this struggle and nobody else understands them. It's like, well, that's a bunch of crap. Like there are people out there. We understand it. A lot of times we've been through it and we want to help. So tell us like what inspired you to, make this film, and, what did you hope to achieve? What were your goals? What did you hope to achieve with it?
Yeah, well, I just, it's pretty simple. The mission statement is I don't want any veteran to ever feel alone. I want them to know it's okay not to be okay and talk to somebody, right? That's the first step. And then for a lot of the allies or the civilian community, a lot of them are just like 3 degrees of separation from a veteran, or maybe they're very close to a veteran. They don't understand because we don't talk. So it kind of peels back the covers a little bit, or the curtain, so to speak, and lets them know really what's going on. And it really opens their eyes. Like the ally community has been one of our biggest supporters. The veteran community supports heavily, but it's more like DMs, right? And like behind the scenes, like, hey man, this really hit me. But the allies are the ones that are just shocked that like their friends are going through this, or their brothers or sisters or whatever. So that's a big thing. It's raising awareness, and it's taken beyond just PTSD. There's bigger problems than PTSD, in my opinion. I think every time something happens, they always like peg it to PTSD. And I wanted to broaden the conversation that it's not just PTSD. I believe when you walk out of those gates for the last time, it may not hit you like day one, day 10, 365 or 5 years from now. It's going to hit you one day. You're going to have a lost sense of purpose, community, and identity, right? I'm no longer fighting a war, right? I'm no longer Sergeant Kershaw. And I'm not with my brothers to the left and right of me that can understand what I'm going through just by a look. And that's ripped from you as soon as you get out, but you don't realize it because you're still thinking about, I'm going to wake up at 8 a.m. and hit the gym and never run 5 miles. That's what your mindset is, right?
Right.
And, you know, I'm never going to stand a parade rest for another grown man. Like, those are the things you're thinking of when you're getting out. And you're just not thinking about the right things or maybe the effects of not just war, but being in a brotherhood like that and being incubated from what society is today in your own little like false reality. So yeah. I think that's what we're trying to raise awareness on, because it's not always the guys that saw heavy combat that are committing suicide.
Yeah, absolutely. And PTSD has, you know, many different forms, I guess.
Yeah,
you call exactly. It, right? You know, a lot of people, you know, get it, and it may come from maybe not even a combat related thing. It could be, you know, something like a car accident or something along those lines, right? But it doesn't always lead to the, you know, that terrible, you know, situation where people are taking their lives, right?
Yeah.
Not to say that it never does. It certainly does.
Yeah.
But you're right. There are those issues, that lost sense of identity, sense of purpose, sense of belonging to a community of people. And knowing that you fit in a group and you get out and you lose all that stuff, like you said, it gets ripped away from you. Now what? Now who are you? Now how do you find that new sense of purpose and sense of belonging and meaning and where does that come from? We've all gone through that. We've all had situations where we're like, holy crap, I'm never gonna be that badass guy again, you know.
Yeah.
For those of us who relate with being a badass, you know. You know,
yeah, I'm filling out an Excel spreadsheet now. Like,
yeah, exactly. Like, where's the sense of purpose and meaning in that? Like, who gives a damn about you know, whether this Excel spreadsheet looks pretty enough or, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
You know, and God forbid you're doing PowerPoint presentations or something, right?
Oh yeah, and you misspell someone's name or just like the sales numbers are off. Yeah, I deal with it all, man. I mean, I'm in sales today, and it's a different mindset, man. And it takes a long time, or for not everyone. Some people, it takes a long time
to
readjust what the new norm is for you.
And, you know, honestly, so I was in the National Guard, and so I had a civilian job when I got out. And so for me, the transition was a little bit easier probably than for some of the active duty folks, right? Because it was just, now I had an extra weekend that was free, you know?
Exactly.
You know, but there was still that sense of purpose and belonging and that community, the guys that I served with, you know, they were going off and they were continuing to serve, and they didn't have their weekends free, but they were going off and spending it together, doing their training and everything, whatever they were doing, I wasn't doing anymore. And so, you know, there was that community that I lost. So, you know, even for the, you know, the reserves, National Guard, like they have that same issue sometimes too, where they're losing that. I mean, it's a little bit different than active duty, but they're still having some of those same types of issues. So, So getting back to the documentary, you know, you're talking about these types of topics to raise awareness, you know, not only amongst the veterans and the military community, but also the allies, the supporters of the military who, maybe they didn't serve, but they want to help those who did serve.
Yeah, and exactly.
If they don't know the issues that we're going through, because we don't talk about them because we're stubborn and, you know, bullheaded, whatever, we just don't do it. You know, how are they going to help? How are they going to know what it is that they can do to help? And so you talk to like a bunch of different veterans, firsthand account from them. Tell us about the process of collaborating with these guys and how their stories contributed to the film and what the mission was.
Yeah. So when I came up with this idea, I was very, very direct on I wanted three separate people that didn't know each other. I felt like some of these documentaries, when you come back from it, you identify them with that unit. That's my opinion. Like, oh, they, they came back and they had that hard deployment and, you know, that's why they are. So you get one perspective of it, right? One unit. And you identify them as that unit. So I wanted three separate guys, three didn't know each other. The only common denominator was me, so I could validate that they weren't telling BS, right?
Sure.
I didn't want any, you know, false stuff going on. So I knew them. I knew them personally, either in the military or professionally. So I brought them together. So I wanted them to be good storytellers. I wanted them to be authentic and just good people. And then also wanted to be around the mission, right? They weren't doing it to get clout. They weren't doing it for any other reason but to help. I know these guys. So I picked, you know, Omar, who was my platoon sergeant, which I thought just, I knew his stories were crazy and I knew some of the stuff he was going through and just was a good dude. He's a warrior, right? Breaking case of war. He needs to be behind a glass, right? Like he's just a warrior and just like good heart, great heart. One of the best human beings I've ever met. A guy I really respect and love. He's like a brother to me and he's just a warrior, man. I remember the first time we took contact in Afghanistan before that mission, right? We were kind of sitting in a dirt berm and it first grade stuck us in like a dirt berm, like thanks. It's just like a half mound thing. And we were running out of water doing our operations out of this thing for a couple of days, hot as hell. And second platoon goes out. So we went in order. First platoon went out, second platoon went out, third platoon went out. And every platoon got engaged that day or gotten some sort of engagement. And then second platoon walks out. As soon as they walk out the little wire, some guy with an AK started popping off at him. This is like the first time we've heard it since we've been there, right? Like direct at us. So there's like a couple guys like freaking out, trying to get on, like, you know, they're trying to get up this cookie crust stuff. They're falling. Like I remember one of my guys, those little out of shape, he like falls and like he's dragging down the thing. And it's like really kind of funny to watch everyone that hadn't experienced combat before, like their first, like, oh, you know, the adrenaline pumping.
Yeah.
And I look over and Hernandez doesn't have a kit on. Like doesn't have anything on because I think he was shaving or like washing his body or something. He's up there like no shirt, just like scanning. He's like, "Where are these MFers at?" Cause he's just like he's like completely exposed. Like I'm like, and this is going on. I'm just watching him. I was like, yeah, "Man, this guy is just a warrior, man." Like, just great to see. Like no fear, putting himself out there for somebody else, and it was that was great, man. And then you got Wade. He's just a character himself with the long hair. He was in Fallujah, Ramadi, and the invasion. I mean, three of the worst you can think of when you think about Iraq, right?
Right.
And a great unit. He's a Marine to the core. Just a great human, very articulate and a very good storyteller. And he's authentic and he went through his own stuff. And then Michael, who's kind of like in the middle, you know, very direct, straight at you, but he has a crazy story himself and he has a different way of telling it. So when people watch it, they're all such three different personalities and they're different perspectives that you might hit a different person identifies with Michael Moore, Wade Moore, Omar Moore. So I wanted that differentiation between the three and collaborating with them was awesome. They were so easy to work with and my brothers.
Yeah. And the stories as I was watching it kind of they came through. You could tell that these guys have been there. This was no BS. They were not bullshitting us. It was like they were there. They experienced this. This was deeply personal to them, and they realize there are other people who, they weren't in that same exact firefight that they were in or that same exact situation that they were in, but they've been in some situations and they're there to share their stories. Not like you said, not for any clout or, get recognized on the street or any of that kind of, that's not what they were there for. They were there to share their stories and be like, "Hey man, you are not alone. We've been there, we understand this." And so you guys talk about the, this, the loss of community getting out and, mm-hmm. You know, the loss of people, while you, mm-hmm. while you're in even, you know, and, the loss of, you know, the purpose and community, in, tell us about the approach. Like what was the thought process behind, you know, sharing these stories and how you were trying to get it to resonate with the viewers?
Yeah. So what I wanted to do was I didn't want to approach a movie about suicide because I didn't think anyone was going to watch it.
Sure.
If that's what it looked like on the thing, if that's what you opened up the scene with, I think we would lose people. What I wanted to do was build up these heroes, in which they are, and I'm not, you know, bullshitting, like they are heroes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to build up and show how strong they were, how proud they were, how confident they were talking about that, and then take a shift of the transition. And almost like I thought about it, like if anyone watches a lot of films, Christopher Nolan, you don't know what he's doing until he does it, like in some of his flicks, like Inception and stuff. If anyone watches Tribal, you notice there's a direct turn at one point. It almost does a 180. And that was very intentional. You know, that was very intentional the way we did it. And that was my vision, was I want to build it up and it almost looked like just a regular cool documentary of watching these heroes and then like, oh, now we're out.
Like
a quick turn. And that's, you know, my directors, Lewis and Brandon Borrego, were amazing at that. I mean, those guys, it was their first film. You know, they were so good. We got, you know, 7 hours of film. They pieced it all together and they were really good. And, you know, we went back and forth and collaborated on all this stuff, but they did a really good job storytelling and meeting the vision that I wanted. And also like telling me when I was wrong, like, no, Mark, this doesn't work. This will work. This will work. Because some of the ideas they brought to the table, I wasn't 100% for. Like if you watch the film, there's like smoke, blue and red smoke.
Yeah.
They were telling me about it. I was like, why? Red smoke? Like, what? Because I didn't have $1 million, right? I had a good amount of money, but I didn't have enough to make it, you know, this, you know, Transformers or whatever. And they told me, but I know, trust us. It's going to be like a dream state and it's like a memory. Trust us. I was like, all right, man. And I think it came out pretty good.
Yeah. And I, when I was watching it, at first I was like, man, the smoke doesn't look that way, you know, but then I was like, oh, wait, this is like kind of like you're dreaming almost, like you're seeing.
Yeah, it's a dream state. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, this now I'm on board with this. Like this makes sense. How it's all laid out. And, you know, even like some of like the flashes of, you know, like when there's, I forget if it was gunshots or an explosion or something, like
you just
need a red light and it just goes, you know, and you could tell like, okay, that's what's going on in this particular situation. So, like it totally made a ton of sense, you know, how that was done. But it is. It's almost like you're kind of dreaming about like what's going on, you know, in the story.
Like it's a memory. You're looking in their head.
Yeah.
You're looking in their head.
Yeah. Kind of cool. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. You know, and so these guys, they came on, they basically, you know, opened up about some of the darkest moments in their lives and their history, you know, very intimate stories that they had to share, you know, about what they went through, but also some of the struggles after serving. You know, they talked about their, you know, battles of anger and resentment and, you know, all these different things that they were going through. But this was all done with the goal of, you know, basically sparking a conversation about these things and connection amongst the veterans and the allies and supporters of the military community. You know, so like this was all intentional, right? Like you wanted, this is what you want. You want these conversations to happen, right?
Yeah. That I mean, that's the goal, right? I mean, people, I think, come out of here when we talk, sometimes we'll do viewings and we'll have panels and they kind of want us to have an answer how to solve it.
Yeah.
That's not, we're not solving it, right? What we're doing is trying to start the conversation with everyone around it. And then also the conversation starts when veterans speak up.
Yeah.
You know, you have to talk about it. You have to speak up. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to break that stigma of it's okay not to be okay and talk to somebody. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing with them. And then raise awareness around, it's a little bit bigger than what you think. It's a little bit more than this and that. Right. That's really what we're trying to do. That conversation is so key, because then somebody smarter than me is going to figure it out. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of folks take this kind of approach, and this is kind of a military sort of approach as well, where you're sort of leading from the front, where you're going to the people who are experiencing the situations or dealing with these problems, and be like, hey, what's your thoughts on this? Mm-hmm. And what's that next guy's thought? And the next person, and the mm-hmm. next person, and the next person. What are your thoughts on how is this affecting you? What can we do better to help you and reintegrate you and get you off on the right foot? And if you ask just one person, you're going to get one person's perspective, and it may be okay, you know, of an idea.
Yeah.
But when you ask, you know, hundreds or thousands, or you talk mm-hmm. to a lot of people, and you get all their ideas together, and you start, you know, piecing them together, you're going to find some common themes where it's like, hey, oh, I'm hearing this a lot. This is the thing that maybe I need to start paying a little bit more attention to. You know, like you said earlier, PTSD is like one of those things where everyone's like, oh, well, you know, a veteran took their life and must have been PTSD. You know, that's just a thing that they throw at it, right? But until they have their eyes open up to the fact that, you know, maybe they felt that loss of community or sense of purpose and belonging and all of that, they don't even, doesn't even occur to them that could be the thing that's the problem for them, you know? And so with that, you have this documentary. It's now opening people's eyes up to this possibility that, hey, man, there's something else out there.
Yeah.
And what do we do about it? Let's start talking about it. And so having these screenings with the panels and everything that you just talked about, I think is, you know, maybe even more important than the documentary itself, is because now you're sparking these conversations. You know, because you can get someone like me who watches it once and it's like, you know, that was a good documentary. You know, triggers some ideas in my head. You know, that's cool. And that it's a good thing. I'm not taking away from that, but when you get a bunch of people together and you watch it, and then it's like, okay, let's talk about it. And, you know, we're not here to give the solution. But we're here to, help facilitate that conversation that may lead to a solution. You know, maybe that's a, hopefully not too simplistic view of what you're trying to do, but, you know, that's kind of, the way I see it is like, this is a really good thing is getting these conversations to start happening.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it raises questions, right? And especially the allies, they have the most questions. The veterans usually, when they're there, they usually speak up and relate to something, say, this touched me for this way. You know what I mean? Or maybe there were some veterans that are still in that haven't gone to combat. They will be the ones that ask questions, but the allies are the ones that really, or the civilians are the ones that ask the most. And having that panel of like me, Wade, Michael, and I'll bring on some other guests like Herb Thompson, Jetta Deloria, Jackie Lofton, guys that were involved in the process with me, or guys I know really well that are authentic. Having those, that panel up there is huge. It's a lot of the times when we did like surveys for feedback of how we can do better, that was one of the things. Like the movie was amazing, but that panel was like the icing on the cake, right? It's very big. And even though it's out on streaming right now, we still are doing those panels and we're still doing those viewings and bringing people together to do those things. So we're still trying to keep the mission going in that aspect.
Yeah. And I think rightfully so. I think you should, you know, continue doing those types of panels because, like you said, that's the icing on the cake. That's maybe the secret sauce that makes this, you said this, earlier, I don't think as we were recording, but I at some point you had said this, maybe it was in the description, but you referred to the film as a force multiplier.
Force multiplier. Yeah.
Yeah. For addressing these issues that folks are having, because it's out there. People can watch it, you know, whether it's in a group setting, like what you're talking about, or it's in a, you know, in the privacy of their home, or they can, you know, wherever they're watching it,
they can
watch this thing. And it's not just one person, a one-on-one conversation, the way you and I are talking right now. It's out there for the whole world to see if they choose to. And now we can start having these conversations because people are getting a little bit more educated. Now that's the beauty of the internet. Is we can get educated on topics if we choose to. The downside of the internet is we can also get really stupid on topics.
You can go down rabbit holes quick.
Yeah, exactly. But in the case like this, if someone's sitting there like, man, why are so many veterans taking their lives? Watch the documentary. You'll find out a whole lot of information about what people are going through, what they went through in combat, but also what they're going through when they get back. And that, I think, is the important piece that we miss, because conceptually, I think a lot of people can maybe grasp a general idea of combat. You know, they've watched the Saving Private Ryan, they have a general idea. They can't get that gut wrenching feel that, when the first bullet starts cracking over your head. They don't get those feelings and, the scared to death kind of emotions that anyone who's been in combat could relate to. They don't get that, but as a general concept, they can understand that. But understanding like that sense of belonging and community and, and I'm not saying they can't understand that. It's just not the first thing that pops in mind when you have these conversations. And that's a thing that I think we need to do a better job at. And your documentary does a great job at talking about.
Yeah. And I think they always relate combat to trauma, right? I think what they don't realize, what we're never going to experience again, is that high of adrenaline that only combat can give you.
Right.
That is a drug, and we chased it as gunfighters, right? Like that is, it was so much fun until something bad happens. You try to compartmentalize the bad times, but nine times out of 10, the bad things didn't happen. Nine times out of 10, you got after the enemy. We are a better fighting force than they are. Yeah. It's fun. That's what you practice to go to. Imagine, guys are joining during the time of not war and are, what if you're on a football team, you practice, never got to play under the lights, right?
Right.
You got to play under the lights. And and when you come back, nothing. And I've told everyone this, nothing. You got to come to terms with, that's why it's so important to find something else you're passionate about. Because if you don't, the rest of your life's going to be in first gear. And that's when it starts going. And because that combat, and then, some of the crazy stuff you see in the barracks where nothing's off limits, like that, like any point in time when you're walking the 82nd Airborne Barracks, some drunk paratroopers PLF in off the third floor, and that's completely normal. You know what I mean? Or random brawls happen. Like it's a normal environment of adrenaline, and you get into society, and it's not that. So I think a lot of us chase that dragon, going to, it's like contracting like Wade did or something like that. And that doesn't face it, because contractors aren't gunfighters, right? They're security, essentially. So that's the other piece, right? It's not always trauma. Trauma's a piece of it, but it's that chasing that dragon that I think gets a lot of us, right?
Yeah, and that adrenaline is, I don't want to understate that. Like that adrenaline is such a huge piece. You get back and it's just like it gets sucked away from you. And you're right, it's a drug. Imagine an addict, who's addicted to, whatever, pick your drug. And then all of a sudden, the world supply of that drug just disappears. And they're like, what the hell, man? Like, I can't get that anymore. Like, it's like when the global war on terror, when that was we pulled out of Afghanistan, and I'm not saying that we don't still have troops overseas and they're still getting after it, but the supply of war had significantly dropped. So now it's like, okay, well, I'm probably not going to get a chance to go to war unless something else pops off. Right. I'm not going to get too many more chances to go over there. Where do I find this adrenaline rush? And I don't know that we understand it as adrenaline, or do we think of it more of, this is just how shit's supposed to be. Like, this is the way life's supposed to be. Is that the way we get kind of reconditioned, or is it, or do we understand it as adrenaline, and do we seek that? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I know it's fun, and it's hard to paintball, whatever. You know, I was a paratrooper jumping out of airplanes. That's cool, but it's in the community, right? You're in like the world's biggest fraternity.
Yeah.
Around guys that you would never, you know, you remember going to formations when guys would be in their civilian clothes?
Yeah.
You got like gothic, you know, rappers, country boys. You're like, what? You wear that? And you get to know people as a person. You're not judging them because you all look the same.
Yeah.
Right. As far as like, you know, their haircuts and, you know, their uniform and stuff like that. Right. You don't judge them by race or anything like that. You judge them by like, oh, Kershaw's a good dude. He's funny. He's a private, you know, go do private things. Right. You know, and society's not that way, unfortunately. And, it's a lot more simplistic and more simple, right? You're not worrying about bills. You're not worrying about, you know, HOA calling something on you. You're not worrying about anything but the mission. And it's really just takes you outside of reality, and you spend a year there. It's not like a weekend, right? Or a week. Yeah. Spend a year there. That becomes normal. And it's hard to, you know, come back to society when society is way different. So
And I think you hit a good point there. Is it's a totally different reality than what you experience in normal day-to-day civilian life. You're right. You don't have to worry about bills when you're over there. You're not worried about you know, whether the paint color that you chose for your house is the right color. That is the HOA going to come in
right
on your door and be like, oh no, this is like a shade off. You got to repaint them. Damn house. It's like, you don't have to worry about, you know, is your trash can out at the right time? For trash pickup or whatever. You know, you don't have to worry about any of those things. It's, you wake up, you go do your job.
Yeah.
And you either come back or you don't.
Yeah.
And then you go back to sleep and then you rinse and repeat and you go do it again.
Yeah. And everywhere you had, you know, if you had weights, if you were lucky enough to have weights there, you work out. It's literally like a warrior's paradise, right? It's fun. So.
Yeah. You eat, you and downtime, you kind of, you know, smoke and joke with the guys and you do those kind of things. But you don't have to worry about, Susie's got a dentist appointment and I got to go take her, you know, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. Like
nothing.
Unfortunately, that lands on the families. That's the stuff that they still have to worry about, you know?
Yeah, and they deploy with you in their own way, right? And that's something else you come back to is that reintegration. And the military does a pretty good job of telling you this and trying to prepare you for that, of like, life is going on without you there. And then you come and you disrupt it a little bit because you're so used to doing things a certain way. And you're trying to get back used to what life is. And then a lot of people, typically after you deploy, unless you go career, you're probably getting out shortly after that at some point. I mean, from a year in or 18 months in.
Yeah.
And you're still trying to reintegrate in your mind. And now you're getting thrusted not only into the military, you know, CONUS, like back where it's safe, and you're reintegrating and, you know, shaving every day and, you know, showing up and, you know, hurry up and wait. And then all of a sudden you got to do something at 5 p.m. when you've been doing nothing all day.
Right.
And then you're out in real society. So it's just like, it happens quicker than what people think. And I think that's an issue.
And even folks, like you said, you come back and you don't know your place really even in your own home.
Yeah.
You may not recognize, you know, where you fit in anymore. You know, before I deployed, to Afghanistan, I was, first time father. My wife gave birth about a month before I deployed. And I was off training most of that time. So I was with son for about 10 days. I got 10 days of leave, where I got to be home with them. And, fortunately I was able to be there for the birth, but then I wasn't really dad, cause I was still like, my mindset was I'm going to war. Like, that's why my mind needs to be, right? And I come back home. My wife had been mom, you know, essentially acting as a single mom for, you know, the 9 months or so before I got back. And now, how do I fit in? How do I fit in as a dad in this house? Like, what do I do? Like,
yeah,
it was just a strange change in dynamic. Because before I left, it was just me and her, and we had our routines and we had our everything, but now we had a baby. It totally like disrupted all of that. And that's another thing that people just don't think about when you get back. It's like, oof, who am I even in my own home? Not just like in the world and society or whatever. It's like in my own home, who am I? Where do I fit in? What do I do? What's expected of me? What's not expected of me? Like, what am I expected to not have to worry about? Or, you know, whatever the case may be, you have this change that goes on, and that takes its toll too on folks. And there's a lot of these conversations that need to have, some airtime, I guess, if you will, for lack of better terms, to get that information out there to folks, so that they understand that it's more complex than just PTSD. The things that the veterans are going through, it's more than just that. There's a lot of things going on, and we need to be aware of that, so that way when these issues pop up, we can help people, and we can do what's necessary so that they get the support that they need. Right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Brandon, one half of the Borrego brothers, he's genius, like very smart, but he's like me. We're both kind of like bullheaded, right? And I remember we were going through like what we want Tribal to be. And I'm like, it has to only speak to veterans. He's like, no, it's bigger than that, Mark. I'm like, no, I don't care what anybody thinks. I was like, care about the veteran, blah, 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 blah. We're like going back and forth for like 2 hours. And then he said something to me that he's like, Mark, this is not a veteran issue. This is a societal issue. And then I stopped and I was like, he's right.
Yeah.
This is bigger. This is a societal issue, right? Just how, in my opinion, society is just different than what it was 50 years ago. And, it's a lot of arguing, a lot of infighting, a place that where we all came together for a common cause, regardless of race, gender, feeling, or how you acted, or whatever it was, we came together and we would protect each other with our own life. And then you come back to society and it's not like that. And I feel like we feel like a square peg in a round hole. Yeah. I think that's what he was getting at. It's a societal issue, Mark. It's not a veteran. It's a societal issue. We just happen to be one of the few people that get ripped from society for a long period of time. And then that's our reality.
That's right.
I think he's right. I mean, I'm not an expert on it, but at face value, it makes sense to me, right?
So. Yeah, it totally makes sense. I think the society as a whole, if you compare society, like civilian society to military culture society, call it its own separate society, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Compare the two. There's no comparison, really. I mean, they're like you said, in the military, I don't care what color your skin is or what your religion is or where you came from,
or how much money you make.
Or how much money exactly. Like I don't care if your parents are rich or poor, or, I don't care about any of that stuff. I care, do you have my back?
Yeah.
That I care about,
Yeah.
And you should
do
know
you do
that
your
I,
job.
Do you do your job? Do you, all that kind of stuff. Like that's the stuff that actually matters. That's the stuff that the answer to those questions are determine whether or not people are coming home in body bags. And I mean, that's a pretty significant thing to think about. So when you get out into civilian society and, you got people who are, bitching because their Starbucks order is wrong or something, like who cares about that? But to those people, that's important to them.
That's important.
That is their, that's their world, and that's important to them. But we look at it like that stuff, who cares? Like, give me the wrong thing. I don't really care. Just I'll take it and I'll deal with it. It's not that big of a deal. And so we find that clash in society, and we you know, maybe rightfully so, we think these people just don't understand us. And in a lot of cases they don't, but documentaries like yours, like Tribal, and other, ways of sharing stories like this really, help to shed some light on what's going on in the military culture to help people understand, that it's not just PTSD, that there's other issues out there. And we are still losing people, and that's the problem. We need to do better as society to help people who need the help and let them know it's okay to speak up and say, hey, I need help. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I've done it. I'm sure, many people out there, they've done it. Just go get the help. Like you said, we're in a different place now than we were 50 years ago, 60 years ago, whatever. Where back then it was like, oh, you're going to talk to a psychologist. You must belong in the nut house, or that was the mindset back then. It's not the case these days, and we've gotten better, but we still got some work to do. We still need to change that stigma, right?
Yeah, I've been out since 2013. But the more I thought about this, I was like, why are we like this? It starts when you join the military.
Yeah.
If I would have spoke up as an infantryman and said I had suicidal tendencies or issues, or I just want to talk to somebody, they take my weapon, they take my shoelaces, they take my belt, put a road guard vest on me in some areas, and basically I know they did.
Yep.
And then you'd have like 24-hour guard all the time. So now you're looked at like a leopard. Everyone's making fun of you. I can't do my job. I'm not a warrior just for asking for help. I don't know if it's still like that anymore. I haven't talked to anybody that's still in and asked them that. But if that's still like that, even half of that, it's never, we're going to be fighting the same problems over and over and over again, because you're taking these guys that you have completely stripped what they are as a civilian, made them a warrior. Turn them into a warrior.
Yep.
Then you tell them warriors don't speak up, and you're going to be reprimanded, even though the chaplain's telling you to speak up, but nope, sergeant's telling you that, your platoon daddy's like, you better not, or you're a pussy or whatever. Right.
Right.
Of course you're not going to speak up. And that's going to, you're still identifying as that veteran when you come out. And of course that's going to be ingrained to you as a warrior, and you're trying to hold on to what shred of a warrior you are. Of course you're not going to speak up. So like, it's got to change within the ranks. And it's got to be more acceptable. And I understand that's a line that's hard to cross, because you're taking guys to war, and there's a certain mindset you have to have when you're going to war. And I understand that, but there's got to be a better way. And I should not be losing more people home to suicide than in Afghanistan or RC's province, or, Anbar province in Iraq or whatever it was, where I should not be losing more people at home, in my opinion. We're not at war here.
Exactly. I feel the same way. I mean, we for sure lost more people here. Personally, I've lost more people here than I did overseas. And
same.
As a military as a whole, just look at the numbers. I mean, I think it's 7,000-8,000, something like that. I forget the exact number, that were lost, over there. And we come back and it's 22 a day. You just do the math over the course of 20 years. That just doesn't compute, like we're losing a lot of people at home, to this stuff. And, you're right. You get those mixed messages, the chaplain telling you go talk to someone, and then, the drill sergeant, no, don't talk to anybody, because you're weak if you do, and blah blah blah, right? I can understand some of the stuff, like if someone says, hey, next time we go to the range, I'm gonna shoot myself. Okay, yeah, you probably don't want to bring that guy to the range,
Yeah, like, that makes sense, right?
That makes sense,
Yeah,
get that guy some help.
Yeah, you take him off the line till he's better, and if it's not for him, it's not for him.
Right.
But it was a statement of, you don't say anything, right? You don't talk about it. And, you know, there are some that are like, oh, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do whatever. Yeah. You got to take that seriously. You got to separate them. That's a few cases, but
yeah,
you know, for all of us, not the speech. Yeah. I don't know.
You know, I was listening to the Jocko podcast the other day, and he said something that really made sense about this topic, about the concept that, you know, we all have, you know, consider it like a cup, that we can fill so much into that cup. Everyone's cup is a different size. You know, some people have a shot glass and some people have, you know, a coffee mug, and some people have, some people have a 5 gallon bucket, and we can put, you know, only so much into those cups before they start to overflow. And you're right. There's some people that you got a shot glass and you're going into the military, you're probably not going to make, you know, and that's not going to be the right thing for you, but you got a bigger cup, and you got someone with a bigger cup, they're going to be okay. Until that cup starts getting a little too full. And at that point, you know, maybe take them off of that job, whatever it is that high tempo job, the, you know, kicking indoors and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Take them off of that for a little bit. You know, you need people to train people. So go have them go do that for a little bit, until that cup comes down, that level comes down just a bit. And then, you know, in the meantime, hey, guess what? You got a little bit more downtime. Go talk to mental health, go get yourself, you know, situated, whatever the situation is, go get that taken care of. And then you might be able to get back into that job. It's not saying, you know, take your shoelaces away, you know, have a road guard vest on all the time and have, you know, suicide watch 24/7 and all that. You know, most people don't, I'm not saying nobody needs that, but, you know, most people don't need that. Most people just need to take a break from all of that. You know, cause we're not, as humans, we're not built to, we're not built for war. Like that's not, we shouldn't be thrust into that for long extended periods. We're built for, you know, the short hunts of, you know, let's go, you know, kill that tiger or, you know, whatever. And now we have meat for, you know, a week or more. Yeah. We don't have to worry about that again for a little bit. You know, we're not built for that extended amount of intense adrenaline rush, that combat gives, right?
Yeah, and I, maybe it's, and I don't know what the numbers of guys in service that do it are as opposed to veterans. I haven't gotten down in the data at that point, but maybe it's just getting more and capturing more when they get out.
Yeah.
Wade said something in the documentary that, to me, it's the best line of the documentary. It says the military does a great job of turning civilians into warriors or killers, but doesn't do a great job of turning warriors into quote unquote normal.
Yeah.
They think teaching you how to write a resume is proper reintegration training, right?
Sure.
Okay. So maybe there just needs to be, like, you know, when guys are, you know, A-capping, right? 6 months, they're not. 6 months out, that's, you're done with your job. 6 months out, unless you're reenlisting, you're done with your job, like, regardless of what it is. Now it's 6 months of reintegration.
Yeah.
And maybe that's it, right? Because remember, when you're in the actual, like, active duty, when you're ACAP and you're still going to the range, you're still doing stuff, that's just, hey, I got an appointment. Not until like the last month, maybe. They're leaving you alone, depending on what unit you're at, right? You know, if you're NCO, it's a little bit harder because they put you on staff duty and all this stuff. But maybe that's it. Maybe it's a mandate of, like, you don't touch these guys 6 months out and you put them with a bunch of guys like them. Like, maybe there's a program built around that. I don't know. Maybe that's a dumb idea, but something needs to be different in that reintegration process. You know what I mean?
I don't think that's a dumb idea at all. I think that's definitely something that should be considered, you know, that we take that and you know, time frame, there's people smarter than me who could figure out, you know, is it 6 months? Is it 3 months? Is it, you know,
whatever
the time frame is, to me, that doesn't matter, but putting something in place where we can see, that we actually give a damn about this transition and this reintegration and all that kind of stuff. Like, that were not going to just push you out the door. And here's your DD-214. You know, give us back our shit and get out of here. Yeah. You know, get on your way. You know, we actually give a damn about, you know, you as a person and what you're gonna be. Maybe it's something kind of like you know, like AA, where you get a sponsor and you have like a, you know, maybe a veteran sponsor. You know, someone who's been
like a mentor or something like that.
Yeah, kind of, maybe sponsors, maybe the wrong
same thing. Same idea. I know what you're talking about, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same thing.
But it's like, you know, we've been there before. Like I've been through the getting out and, you know, happy to help where I can, you know, and you know, if I can't help because it's outside of my skill set or whatever, I can at least help point you in the right direction and say, hey, you know, those people over there, they're the ones who are able to help. You know, with XYZ, whatever issues you might be having, maybe it's financial issues or, you know, career transition, you know, that type of thing. You know, not knocking the military for what they do, you know, obviously learning how to write a resume. It's an important thing.
It's a skill, a skill set.
And when you got people who've been in the military for 20 years and that's the only job that they've ever had is in the military, you know, from the time they were 18 till, you know, the time that they got out. They've never written a resume. They never had to.
Yeah.
And
they don't know what to wear to an interview.
Yeah, exactly. Because they've never been to one. They never needed to go to an interview. You know, so you got a 38-year-old guy who doesn't know how to write a resume or what to wear to an interview or how to even, you know, act in an interview. Like what are you supposed to do when you get there? All that stuff's important. But there's other stuff that's important too. Yeah, I think is the point. And having somebody there, to help you out, because the classes that they give you and the everything, it's like drinking from a fire hose. You're not going to remember all that stuff, but having a mentor or sponsor, whatever you want to call it, somebody who you can call up and be like, just ask some questions when those questions come up, you know, because they're not going to come up while you're sitting in a classroom. They're going to come up 6 months down the road or a year down the road or, you know, 2 years down the road where it's like, hey, now I'm having this question. Who do I talk to? The military doesn't give you a phone number of people to call, you know, 2 years later that you can call and be like, hey, I need help with, you know, whatever the issue is. But having a mentor, I think that would actually be a pretty good idea. And
that makes sense.
And doing that with that, like, you know, 6 months out where you get to kind of introduce yourself to that person and, you know, maybe combined with what you're talking about, I think that would help out tremendously.
But, I mean, you have someone guiding them.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
You know,
it's something needs to change because it's all about get it. Like they do a little bit. Do you need help? Talk about it. Blah blah blah. But it's some lady that's never or man or whatever.
Yeah.
Typically, was not relating to you, telling you to go talk. Right. So
yeah.
They need like develop something of guys that have done it that want to help, because also what that does, if you get dudes or gals that were in combat that are struggling and you put them in that mentorship, because what I mean by struggling, they could be successful professionally and still be struggling. And
for sure,
now you're giving them it's a spiral effect. You're giving them just like tribal, right? When people watch it, they feel like they're a part of the tribe and it gives them purpose. And maybe that helps because you're giving veterans that want to help, they don't really know how to, or they don't believe in all this stuff. You're giving the ones that did struggle a purpose to help others. So it's like a spiral effect. You're helping those people too. That's why veterans help. It makes us feel good, right? And gives us a purpose.
Yeah.
We want to help because it's naturally in us.
You know, and I was talking to somebody else a little while ago, and that we were talking about how, you know, the helping other people, not only does it help that person who is struggling with whatever they're going through, it helps you too.
Yeah, it does.
You feel good when you are helping other people. And like there's that we shouldn't underestimate like how powerful that is. You know, that feel good, you know, thing about that makes you have that sense of purpose again. You're now you're now doing this for somebody else. You're doing this to make sure that that person succeeds. You don't want that. Yeah. You don't want to let that person down. And, yeah. You talk about like reducing the suicide rate. When you have a purpose and a mission and that person is depending on me to be there for them, to show up,
well, man, I'm going to be
there. I'm going to show up, I'm there. And that's maybe one of the pieces that we're missing. I don't know.
Maybe it's gotta be better than what they're doing now, in my opinion.
But here's the thing with all of this, we're having that conversation right now. And
yeah, it's true. We're right talking about it.
Right now, it's just two guys having a conversation. Two guys who've seen combat, who've had people who in their lives who've struggled, and unfortunately, we've lost some people along the way, and we're having a conversation about this. Somebody else who might be listening, this might spark an idea in their head, and they're like, "Hey, I got a great idea." Based on what I just listened to from this conversation, I'm going to go do this thing, or I'm going to go talk to other people about this thing. And it's going to spark something, and the more conversations we have like this, and like the conversations that you had in the documentary and tribal, the more conversations we have, the more good ideas will come from it. Yeah. And guess what? We're going to get some bad ideas coming from it too. But guess what? Those bad ideas, we'll figure out real quick. They're bad ideas. We're just not going to do that. Right? But we're going to get better ideas the more conversations we have. So we got to keep talking about this. And that's, I think, the point of tribal. And I'm really appreciative of you and everybody who was involved in it, for putting it together and getting it out there so that we can have these conversations. And it sparks the conversations anyways. Right.
Yeah, no, that's what it's about, what we just went through in this conversation. That's why we did it, right? And I hope many more come out of it.
Absolutely. So before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to let people know where they can go check out Tribal. I know you said it was streaming. Where can they find it? Piece of information you might want to share either about it or anything about what we talked about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, you can stream it on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, Vudu, or if you have like Verizon or Comcast, it's on video and on demand today too. And anyone that's just looking to watch an authentic documentary that doesn't pull any punches, that tells you what I believe and others is the real issue of what's going on and how we actually feel. It's not political. It's not left or right. It is the truth and nothing but the truth. So help us God, right? And then for the veterans, hopefully it gives you a sense that you're not alone in this fight. We're all here with you. We've all gone through it, regardless of rank or whatever it is or whatever unit you're in. We've all gone through it.
Yeah.
And then for the civilians, it gives you a little bit of an idea, a glimpse into that life so you can understand and give a sense of clarity of maybe how to approach or how to identify it. So anyone that wants to watch it, I welcome you to.
Absolutely. And that's what I got from it when I watched it. It's raw. It's real. It tells people the story of these folks who were featured in the documentary. And, it did a great job telling their stories. I think prompting these conversations to help, spark, some sort of, maybe we'll find a solution. Maybe we won't, but maybe we'll get that conversation going to lead us to something that resembles a solution anyways,
Exactly.
So, exactly. So before we wrap this episode up, I know a lot of times these conversations that we have, they can be a little dark, a little heavy, and sometimes we need a little humor at the end of the day to make us laugh a little bit. I like to do a segment, especially when I have another veteran on the show, called Is it Service Connected? We just take a view at a funny video of some service member doing something stupid or falling, or, you know, kind of think of it like America's Funniest Home Videos, where people do stupid things and we get to laugh at it. And I don't think there's anyone better to laugh at other military folks than other military folks. So
100%.
So when we watch these things, we like to laugh at each other, and it's all good natured. It's all in fun. So I'm gonna pull this video up here so you can take a look. Usually they're just real quick, short videos. And so for the audio listeners here, I'll try to share what's going on. Looks like there's a soldier on some sort of obstacle course, like a bar he's about to jump over. Let's take a look and see what happens. He's about to jump, man. And he hits his
there
gut.
There it is.
Yep, nails it, right? He hits his gut right on the bar and falls right into the water, the muddy, murky water down below. Oh,
that looked like that looked like Ranger School, man. It's terrible.
Yeah, that looked like it looked like he was all like got the face paint on. He was ready to go. He was
ready to roll.
Yeah. He was ready to tackle that thing until it.
You ever tried that obstacle? You ever tried that obstacle?
That's not easy.
That's not easy, man. That guy. That guy that hits it straight chest and I fall, and then I just try to like weasel my way around it.
Yeah,
move on. Right. Maybe they'll give me a pass. Yeah, that's not an easy obstacle. You got to actually be an athlete, which most of us aren't.
No. And that's the thing. I don't think many people realize this. Like when you talk about military, you're thinking like the elite, like they're thinking Navy SEAL, you know, like they're thinking like the elite of the elite, like the top, physical condition. I've served with some guys who are not that.
No, and even like
I wasn't that either. I'm not saying I was some super soldier or anything either, but my gosh, like there are some people there are not that. So that
and even the top of the top, like they're mentally tough and they can run and ruck forever, but get an infantry company playing organized basketball and you'll see some just I got the ball, you know, just like running down the thing, like these guys, you know, can run 2 miles and ruck forever and do whatever, but like you get them playing a coordination sport, it ain't fair.
No, it's it not ain't fair, yeah exactly. So that one there, I mean, it looks like he got probably the wind knocked out of him as he hit that.
Oh, that was bad.
But you know, I don't think any service connection there, unless he, you know, landed on his head wrong or something like that in the water. No. But he's probably okay. So I think he'll be
ego's hurt. That's about it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, especially if it's caught on video.
That looked like BDUs too. So that's been like
that's old school
for like 30 years. So
yeah,
that sucks.
Yeah, it sucks.
That sucks.
Basically, sucks for that guy. It's
sucks
caught
me,
on
you.
Video.
Yeah.
But you know what? He'll be okay. I think.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, everything's all right.
I drink
there,
water. So. He'll be fine.
Yeah.
Builds character, exactly. Right?
Yeah. Change your socks.
Yeah. They're change your socks. Be all right.
All right. Well, thank you again, Mark, for not only for taking the time to come on the show and share your story, but for putting out that documentary, Tribal. Again, I'll have a link to it for the folks who want to check it out. Check it out on Amazon Prime and Apple TV and all the other places that Mark mentioned earlier. I'll have links to that in the show notes for folks to check out the show. Definitely check it out. I highly encourage it. So thank you again for everything that you did.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Sun, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.